Ave Maria in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. Welcome to Ave Maria in the Afternoon, examining the world through the lens of faith from the heart of the Church to help us navigate the culture. Here's Dr. Marcus Peter.
And good afternoon, everybody. Happy Monday, and welcome to another day of Ave Maria in the Afternoon. As I mentioned in the first hour, we are doing similar to what we've done in previous years. If you listen to Al's program over the last several years, you know he always spent the end of December doing what we called the Cresta Countdown. I was typically your host for that. As we looked back, we would rank the top interviews and the top commentaries of the year. And Marcus and I talked about this a lot over the last few weeks, exactly how we wanted to honor the legacy of the old program, also share with you what we've been doing on Ave Maria in the Afternoon since July, and just the simple fact that we had almost three different programs this year. There was Cresta in the Afternoon, hosted by Al Cresta from January to about April. There was Cresta in the Afternoon, hosted by Marcus Peter from April to July. And then since the summer, of course, Ave Maria in the Afternoon. And so what we're going to be doing over the next couple of weeks is sharing everything with you. Some older Marcus interviews when he was filling in for Al. Certainly some of Marcus's more recent material. But we would just be remiss if we didn't take this one opportunity to share with you some of the more Al's commentaries, some of his interviews, and you could just hear his voice again. And as I was doing the editing on these over the last several days, it really made it feel real to me again that, man, what a gift Al was. And we're going to start off this hour of the program with a commentary from Al asking a really important question about holiness and what does it mean to live holiness in our marriage? This is an idea he explored a lot on the Good News Cruise that he was on with Sally and many of our other hosts last January. And of course, Al, with so many questions you'd ask Al, he might quote some obscure documentary, he might go to a philosopher you've never heard of, but the first place he would go was the scriptures. And some of Al's favorite scriptures were found in the writings of St. Paul. And there's a question in St. Paul that seems to imply that taking religious vows is a higher calling than marriage. But if you look at it in its greater context, you can see, well, actually, we're all called to holiness. And he's going to discuss that in the first segment of this hour. We will also hear from Marcus, who talked about the National Eucharistic Congress with our friend Greg Popchuk, and explore the grief of dads and what it's like to lose a child with Patrick O'Hearn. All of that is coming up in a very full hour after this news break.
Thank you, Bryant, and good afternoon, everyone. This is your Ave Maria Radio News for Monday, December 23rd. It's the feast of St. Margaret de Youville. And today's news is brought to you by the Ave Maria Family of Funds at AveMariaFunds.com. President Biden is commuting the death sentences of 37 people, leaving only three federal prisoners on death row in America. Biden announced this morning that he condemns the murders committed but can't in good conscience advocate for the death penalty at the federal level. Biden's administration has imposed a moratorium on executions, and the president says he can't let a new administration resume the executions that he halted. One of the victims of last week's shooting at a Christian school in Madison, Wisconsin, has been laid to rest. A public memorial at City Church in Madison was packed on Saturday with members of the community who were mourning 14-year-old Ruby Vergara, one of three people killed last Monday in a shooting at Abundant Life Christian School. The public service was followed by a graveside memorial service about 12 miles east of Madison. President-elect Trump is threatening the U.S. could take back control over the Panama Canal. Yesterday at Turning Point USA's America Fest, Trump told the conservative crowd, "It will happen if Panama does not stop overcharging the U.S. for use of the key Central American waterway." Trump called the fees being charged by Panama ridiculous and highly unfair. And it's Festivus, the made-up holiday from the 90s sitcom Seinfeld. Celebrated every December 23rd, the alternative Christmas holiday involves food, family, and the airing of grievances. After that, you can wrestle friends and family as feats of strength. The holiday was inspired by real-life Seinfeld writer Dan O'Keefe's holiday traditions. From the AveMariaRadio.net news desk, I'm Dan McGraw.
You're listening to the Ave Maria in the Afternoon, 2024 Year in Review. And welcome back as we continue our review of 2024 at Ave Maria Radio. And as I promised in the opening to this program and opening to this hour, we're going to be hearing in this segment a commentary from Al. Al, of course, always loved responding to listeners. What he would typically do, somebody would email him a question, he'd write about a 5-page response and always started off with, "This is probably more than you're looking for," but then he'd be able to turn that around and use that as a commentary as well. And knowing that whatever the person that, you know, shared the question, a lot of other people were probably thinking that as well. And that is what led to this commentary we're going to be hearing in a second. Question being, are there passages of St. Paul that imply that certain religious orders, certain religious lives, certain vocations are higher callings than the calling of marriage? And as Al's going to point out, well, that's almost immaterial because we are all called to holiness. Let's hear what Al has to say.
And well, there are passages in St. Paul which can be interpreted to see marriage as not as acceptable as singleness, but it's unclear. What is unmistakably clear, though, in St. Paul is what we now call the universal call to holiness. It wasn't new at the Second Vatican Council. It's universal, married or unmarried alike. And that was true when I was growing up in the 1950s and early 60s. Why didn't it get down into my head? I don't know. I mean, seventh graders, it's hard to get into their head anyways. But it was a distortion of Catholic spirituality. Would it have made a difference in my life? I have no idea. But I do know now, in my adult life, it's made all the difference. Baptism unites us with Christ. And that's why we can be called saints in anticipation. His life is our identity. In 11 of St. Paul's 14 letters, all the baptized believers are called saints. And this is not because they were especially virtuous. The Corinthians in particular had serious moral and doctrinal problems. They were divisive. They approved incest. They had twisted understandings of the resurrection. But St. Paul calls them saints because it's expected that the life of God, the grace available in the sacraments and the scriptures in our life together as the Church of Jesus Christ, would carry us through to claim our full identity in Christ. We are saints in anticipation of fully sharing in his divine life. So St. Paul writes, Romans 1:7, to all those in Rome who are loved by God and called to be saints, 1 Corinthians 1:1, to the Church of God that is in Corinth, to those sanctified in Christ Jesus, called to be saints, 2 Corinthians 1:1, to the Church of God that is at Corinth with all the saints who are in the whole of Achaia. And you could go on, to the saints in Ephesus, to the saints in Christ Jesus at Philippi, to the saints in Christ at Colossae. The universal call to holiness is not an innovation of the Second Vatican Council. It runs throughout the entire New Testament. In fact, it's part of our DNA. We are all called to be saints, the lay state, every bit as much as the religious or the ordained. Now, throughout church history, this has had to be emphasized time and again. So St. John Chrysostom, again, in the 4th and 5th century, makes the point, quote, "You certainly deceive yourself and are greatly mistaken if you think that there is one set of requirements for the person in the world and another for the monk. The difference between them is that one is married and the other is not. In all other respects, they will all have to render the same account, for all people must reach the same point. And this is what throws everything into disorder, the idea that only the monk is required to show a greater perfection while the rest are allowed to live in laxity. This is not true. It is not. Rather, Paul says the same philosophy or same way of life is demanded of all." In the early 20th century, Léon Blois, the French Catholic novelist, makes this point in his novel, The Poor Woman. He closes with this line, really famous line, "The only sadness is not to be saints," end quote. Why is this such a sadness? Because to be less than a saint is to be less than the man or woman you were created to be. This is the ultimate sadness, the ultimate despair. We are created for communion with God. But as Hebrews 12:14 warns, without holiness, no man shall see God. It's not proud or arrogant to aspire to become the saint God designed you to be. It's not arrogant to find your identity as a man or woman created in the image and likeness of God. That's our nature. And to fulfill our nature, we must become perfectly conformed to Christ. That is, become a person who perpetually knows the will of God and keeps it. I think people have a hard time getting this into their emotional life. They think it's somehow asking too much to desire to be a saint. But look at the Hebrew slaves in Egypt, right? They're escaping Egypt. They don't strike me as particularly good candidates for sainthood. I mean, they moan and complain about their diet of manna. They carry out Operation Golden Calf. They belittle Moses. They gripe about God's leadership in the wilderness. They even long to go back to Egypt where they were slaves. But these ingrates are all called to holiness, perfection, maturity. Sainthood is not just for an elite holiness task force. I was going to say holiness is for the great unwashed masses, but after the Exodus from Egypt, God's people have been washed in the waters of the Red Sea, which is a type of baptism. And then they hear God from Sinai reveal himself, "I am the Lord who brought you up out of Egypt to be your God. Therefore, be holy, as I, the Lord your God, am holy." St. Peter, our first pope, picks this command up in the New Testament as well. 1 Peter 1:16, "Be holy in all your conduct, because it is written, you shall be holy, for I am holy." And so what is holiness? Well, it means to be set apart. It means to be unique, distinct, different. Holiness in humans refers to their being set apart for service to God. Human holiness is the imitation of God, becoming and acting like him. When we're holy, we are different, set apart, distinct from this world. We take our marching orders not from the world of flesh or the devil, but from the one whose kingdom doesn't originate in this world. He's the one who's creating a distinct and new humanity, born again through faith and baptism. You know, we've got the rebirth of the human race in Christ. Those of us who would think of marriage as second best should really wake up and notice that both the Old and New Testaments use marriage as the central analogy depicting the union between God and Israel, between Christ and the church. I mean, the scriptures start off with God presiding over the marriage of Adam and Eve, and the scriptures end with the wedding supper of the Lamb, when Christ's bride, the church, will be fully united with her bridegroom, Christ himself. Marriage is destined and designed by God to show forth his relationship to us. Under the old covenant, he's the husband, Israel is the spouse. In the New Testament, Christ is the bridegroom, the church is the bride. Gary Thomas, in his book Sacred Marriage, really drives this home. He said, "Understanding the depth of these analogies is crucial, as they help us determine the very foundation on which a truly Christian marriage is based. If I believe the primary purpose of marriage is to model God's love for his church, I'll enter into this relationship and maintain it with an entirely new motivation, one that's hinted at by St. Paul in his second letter to the Corinthians. So we make it our goal to please him. So the goal of my marriage is to please God." I think that, again, as I said, we don't know what we don't know. And I didn't know a lot about marriage when I was a kid. That's true of all of us. But even as I entered into marriage when I was 24 years old, you make these bold and audacious promises that if you really were to think about it, after 50 years of marriage, you'd wonder how in the world you got through it. But again, a Catholic understanding of marriage is, in fact, one of the most motivating activities in this world.
Indeed it is. And those of you who knew Al and Sally know what a witness their marriage was to this calling of holiness. We'll have more to say on that in the rest of this program We'll be back with more on Ave Maria in the afternoon.
A baby's heart is beating 18 days from conception.
Hello, I'm Marian Kuharski, the director of Pro-Life Across America. We're non-political and totally educational. We don't scream or scold. Instead, we help people working through unplanned pregnancies know their options, and we rely on people like you to help with our mission. Check us out on Facebook, YouTube, or at ProLifeAcrossAmerica.org.
Pro-Life Across America, the billboard people.
Get detailed descriptions of Ave Maria Radio guests on their website, AveMariaRadio.net. Go to the archives, find your favorite program, and then find links or books mentioned in that program. That's AveMariaRadio.net.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is sponsored by Workforce Pay Hub, providing payroll, time tracking, HR management, and benefits administration, all with a dedicated customer-centric service team. More information can be found at workforcepayhub.com.
This show is underwritten in part by the following nonprofit company.
My dear brothers and sisters, I'm Bishop Gerald Vinke of the Diocese of Salina in Kansas. This year, you can create a Christmas miracle for a child growing up in the extreme poverty of a developing country. By donating to Send a Box of Joy, you will surprise a child with what could be the first Christmas gift of his or her life. You can bless a child today by donating at boxofjoy.org.
You're listening to the Ave Maria in the Afternoon, 2024 Year in Review.
Good afternoon, welcome back. I'm Marcus Peter. The National Eucharistic Congress has kicked off this week, and how can we encounter Christ in the Eucharist and allow that encounter to help us create a more loving, connected, and caring Catholic family life? We are joined by a friend of mine, Dr. Greg Popchek, who is joining us from the Congress. He's the director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute, a group pastoral telecounseling practice providing Catholic integrated marriage, family, and individual counseling services to Catholics around the world. He and his bride, Lisa, are the developers of the Catholic Home app, created to help build strong, faithful families, and they're the host of More to Life, produced here at Ave Maria Radio and aired on EWTN. Greg, great to have you on the program.
It's fantastic to be here, Marcus. Thank you so much for having me.
Oh, the joy is completely mine. Thank you for making the time. So I want to ask immediately, you are at the National Eucharistic Congress, and we've had such a gear up towards this auspicious event. We're already seeing fruits of the processions, of the organizing, of the gear up events that have led to this great Congress. So what's the feel like on the floor?
Oh, it's really exciting to see so many people coming already. Of course, the event starts Wednesday evening, but the setup is going on all day today and tomorrow, and just the people just working together to build the experience for all the participants and the volunteers. We, for our home experience, we've got 13 Sisters of Life volunteering to help families through the whole event. It's just been amazing.
Wow. Well, I'm glad to hear that. So, Greg, let's talk about the Eucharist in terms of the domestic church. You and your bride are very strong proponents of that language, and it's all too often language that's not heard enough in anywhere from homilies to in terms of the evangelical nature of the church. But the fact is, every family is, by virtue of its being a family in the life of the Catholic Church, a domestic church, and the Eucharist ought to be central to that.
That's absolutely right. So the kind of central message of Catholic Home, that's Catholic HOM, Households on Mission, both the app and the larger program, is just this idea that the Eucharist is the key to our Catholic home, our Catholic Households on Mission. Because when we encounter Christ, you know, when people in the Bible encountered Christ, everything about the way they lived and loved changed.
Yes.
And so when we encounter Christ in the Eucharist, especially as families, everything about the way we live together and love each other should change as well. And so what we're doing through Catholic Home, the app, and the Catholic Home experience at the National Eucharistic Congress is showing families how to bring that Eucharistic grace home so that they can encounter Christ more meaningfully at home and experience the faith as a source of the warmth in the home as well.
Right. And, the apostolate of you and your bride is essentially built off of what the Second Vatican Council really wanted to reignite, this language of the Ecclesia Domestica, the domestic church, and how the parents ought to reclaim in each family the role of being prime formators and heralds of the faith with regard to their children.
Well, that's right. And so, even though the Second Vatican Council resurrected the term domestic church, which was used in the early first centuries of the church, there's not been a lot done to develop the meaning of the domestic church. So, for example, the Catechism does refer to the domestic church as a specific realization and revelation of ecclesial communion, which, of course, is theologically correct, but kind of practically useless in some ways. So one of the first things that we did, when I say we, I mean us, and we had a whole team of theologians and social scientists and folks who were talking about, how could we renew domestic church life? One of the first things we had to do was define it better in a practical way. And so our definition is a household of persons united to each other and the church through the sacramental life of the church, and then committed to living out the Christian, specifically Trinitarian, vision of love in their relationships with each other in the world. Every household, the degree to which our household reflects that definition is the degree to which you already are a domestic church, and the degree to which we struggle to reflect that definition is the degree to which we're called to become an even more dynamic domestic church. But every household that at least shares the sacrament in some way has the foundations of being that domestic church, but then we're called to so much more, to really be outposts of grace and God's love in a hurting world.
Right.
And that's really what this mission is all about. How do we connect with Christ in the Eucharist in a way that makes us want to go home and live, not just as the common, everyday, struggling families that we all are, but as families who are committed to being these domestic churches, these lights in our community.
So let's zoom in then on the reality of the National Eucharistic Congress. The USCCB wants all the faithful in the country to reclaim an ardent fervor and zeal for Christ's presence, substantial presence in the Holy Eucharist. How can parents, as they're participating in this, whether by distance or approximately at the event, how can that transform the lives of parents first, and then how can they then model this for their children?
Well, we talk a lot about what we call this liturgy of domestic church life. Mm-hmm. And a liturgy is a form of worship that was given to us by God, right? So nobody decided, for example, to invent the liturgy of the Eucharist and say, let's come up with a way to turn bread and wine into the body and blood of Christ. God had to do that.
Right.
Well, God had to make families, too. We didn't create ourselves. Family isn't a social contract. It's a revelation. And God made families at the beginning of time and built into those families, his design of families, certain practices that enable them to be healthy and united with his grace, holy as well. And those practices we call the liturgy of domestic church life. And so we talk about this a lot on our show. We talk about this in our books. So people are free to learn this in lots of different ways. But one of the ways that we like to support families in living out this liturgy of domestic church life, which effectively helps families bring the grace of the Eucharist home so that they can be transformed by it in their daily lives, is through our Catholic Household and Mission app, the Catholic Home app. Because on the app, we're really committed to helping families live this different way of life, which is challenging and kind of scary. So, every day our whole team of pastoral counselors is on the app taking questions from parents about parenting issues, about living the faith at home, about overcoming the challenges they face as they try to be faithful Catholics in today's world. We've got tons of creative resources and podcasts. We've got an animated series that teaches even the smallest kids what it means to be a domestic church and how to be a Catholic home. And so, every day we're trying to help families live out this Eucharistic mission in their homes through the Catholic HOM app. And so that's, I hope that people will be able to be part of that community as a way of bringing the Eucharistic revival home, whether they just learn the liturgy of domestic church life on their own or they become part of the Catholic home community. Because it was Bishop Michael Moradian who said that the liturgy of domestic church life is the mystical vehicle that communicates Eucharistic grace through the living body of Christ.
Mm-hmm. And there's a real directed role here when it comes to fathers. You think about the catechism that speaks about the father of the family having a exercise of the common priesthood in the household in a privileged way. Particularly, there's a real rousing call for men of the family to rise up in terms of reclaiming a Eucharistic domestic life.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's true, and unfortunately, most Catholic boys are not raised to fill that role. And so this framework really shows both dads and moms what it means to exercise that common priesthood in their homes, consecrating everything they do throughout the day by living out Christ's sacrificial love in the way that we share affection as families, in the way that we discipline our kids, in the way that we create rituals for working, playing, talking, and praying together, in the way we look for opportunities to care for each other and the people we meet throughout the day. You know, all those little things that our families already do, we're empowered to do them more intentionally and in a way that draws us closer to each other and God through this liturgy of domestic church life framework. And it is that liturgy that belongs to the common priesthood, right? Because we can't have a priesthood without a liturgy.
That's right.
How priests do their work. But we don't really talk about what is this liturgy that accompanies the common priesthood. We would suggest that this liturgy of domestic church life that enables the common priesthood to consecrate the world to Christ.
Mm. So we only have under a minute left in the segment.
Sure.
Just in terms of right now, very practically, as the National Eucharistic Congress is taking place, what are some things that families can do to revitalize their domestic church liturgy?
I think the first thing is to ask God, you know, Lord, teach us how to love each other and teach us to be the family that you want us to be.
Mm-hmm.
You can have a family of Christians, but you can't have a Christian family unless you're praying together every day.
Right.
And the best way that we can pray is by going to God and saying, Lord, teach us to be the family that you want us to be. Show us what that means to love each other the way you want us to love each other. Start there and let the grace flow.
Well, thank you so much, Greg. And we are going to continue future conversations with Dr. Greg Popchak, Director of the Pastoral Solutions Institute, which is a group pastoral telecounseling practice providing Catholic integrated marriage, family, and individual counseling services to Catholics around the world. For Ave Maria in the Afternoon, I'm Marcus Peter.
Ave Maria in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization: Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically owned shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
CMF Curo is a Catholic healthcare ministry providing families nationwide with a better solution centered around whole health, spirit, mind, and body. Our members share their medical burdens within a faith-filled community. At CMF Curo, our members have access to a spiritual director, concierge services, and other health and spiritual resources. Find out if CMF Curo is a better solution for your family. Visit MyCatholicHealthcare.com. That's MyCatholicHealthcare.com.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
I've seen the difference in my son since he's been at Ave Maria. He's happy, he's excited about what he's going to do with his degree, and he's living his faith.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
I said to the sisters one day, what do you think you're going to look like in heaven? Oh, some of them had absolutely magnificent ideas. I didn't think of one of them. So I got desperate because then my turn came. I didn't know what to say. And so in desperation, I said, what do you think I'll wear in heaven? And they all said with one voice, armor!
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Why does marriage require complete fidelity between spouses? The Catholic Catechism states that the intimate union of marriage is a mutual self-giving of two persons ordered to the welfare of their children, which requires that there be an unbreakable union between them. The deepest reason is found in the fidelity of Christ to his church. Through the sacrament of matrimony, the spouses are able to represent that fidelity and witness to it. For these reasons, the spouses can be nothing but completely faithful to one another. Marriage is such a deep, personal union of giving oneself to the other that it cannot, the Catechism asserts, be an arrangement until further notice. As difficult as it may seem to retain this indissolubility for a lifetime, it is made possible by God's irrevocable love in which the couple shares and which will support them through their marital journey. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help, not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them, check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books, on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
You're listening to the Ave Maria in the Afternoon, 2024 Year in Review. And welcome back as we continue looking back on some of these conversations we've had over the last year. In the next two segments, we're going to be hearing a conversation that Mark has had during that window when he was filling in for Al on Cresta in the Afternoon, and exploring really a serious topic, that is the grief of dads. There is no greater trauma a parent can experience than the loss of a child, but for a variety of reasons, a father's grief often fades into the background when his child dies. Patrick O'Hearn and his wife have lost two children to miscarriages, and he has joined other grieving dads to create a resource for anyone experiencing this deepest of pain. And Patrick joins us. Take it away, Marcus.
Patrick O'Hearn and his wife have lost two young children to miscarriage, and we're talking about his book, The Grief of Dads. Patrick, really glad to have you on the program.
It's a joy to be here. Thanks for having me.
I want to begin by saying that this book was a difficult read. I can only imagine it was a difficult task to write.
It was, you know, I called upon so many saints to help me write this book because it, you know, it brings back, you know, so many memories that often when you lose a child, often that healing comes from looking forward, but at the same time it can be, you know, bring healing too, just recalling, just even the blessing, you know, even that I never got a hold of my children because my wife miscarried them, but I think you know, we wanted to write a book that just can speak to so many men's hearts that are they're forgotten. So definitely it was a painful book, but I think, you know, it, all the suffering, I pray that it bears fruit and can really help some father that's going through one of the most darkest times of his life.
Yeah. Patrick, I just want to start right off the bat by sharing with you that my bride and I relate with you and your bride. We lost two children as well, and in virtually the exact same way that you and your bride lost your children. And I was passed on the feast of St. Maximilian Kolbe and Our Lady of Sorrows, and those were feast days that were very important to us, just like your children's passing on those days were very important to you and your bride.
I'm sorry for your losses. I know it's just you never want to see anyone lose a child, and even, you know, I think even the culture we live in, you know, even the miscarriage, I see this even in the Catholic Church, it's almost like it's not totally pro-life because, you know, when someone has an abortion, we're all over it. But when someone has a miscarriage, it's like there's no support for them. So again, I'm sorry for your loss, and I pray that somehow, yeah, this book can speak to that, the sacredness of every life.
You know? It did. And in particular, what you wrote about male grief and about what the father goes through and how you pointed out very matter-of-factly, very pointedly, that most men feel more marginalized and less acknowledged than women following loss. I think it's just one of those societal things. When a couple loses a child, for some reason, everyone bands around the mother, and to a large degree, rightfully so, but that father lost their child too. No one wanted to have that conversation, and it frankly baffled me.
It did. You know, even in my workplace, you know, people would come up to me, how's your wife doing? And after the first miscarriage, I didn't even tell people about the second one because it's, you know, the first one I didn't really even get a reaction. I guess I was just hoping for some consolation. And just recently, and just I kind of discovered that even, I'm not trying to bash Catholic companies, but just in general, though, you see very little even days off for men, you know, when their wife has a miscarriage. It's like they're back, you know, I went back to work right after I got the phone call from my wife, and I had to go back into work, but it would have been nice to have like 1 or 2 days off just to spend time, you know, with your wife and to grieve this child. And I think that we can do better as a Catholic church and, you know, even our Catholic organizations, because a lot of these secular companies that have these, you know, woke agendas, they're offering miscarriage support, right. You know, giving bereavement days for a miscarriage. So I think as, you know, as men and, you know, again, in our church, I think this is one step. Hopefully this book will show the world that, you know, no miscarriage is, you know, it is, it's all, you know, you can't like quantify a life, you know, a child dying, you know, we compare that. Sometimes I felt like, well, maybe my child's death in a miscarriage is not as important as someone that lost an adult child, but you know, it's a life, and I have the right to grieve, and I ought to grieve the loss of that child.
Yeah. And again, I relate with you, right? I think somehow us men, particularly as we move into marriage, we are ingrained with this societal expectation of being able to tough it out, as if the loss of our child wouldn't in any way emotionally affect us. And so the expectation is you have to be a pillar for your bride. In fact, so many people told me that you have to be strong for her. And you know, I'd listen to that in silence. I obviously didn't go off on those people, but I was breaking inside, and I certainly didn't handle that well. It would take months before I was able to function emotionally with some level of equilibrium. And it's one of those areas where I guess we as a church, this is where the rubber meets the road. If we call ourselves pro-life, this is one of those areas we need to get better at.
Definitely, you know, and I look back and I regret that. Even in front of my wife, you know, I didn't shed tears that often in front of her. As often I was driving home from work and I'd be in the car and just, you know, they would come down. But and I felt like she wanted that. Like, but at the same time, then I felt like I'd embraced this role. I have to be the strong one. But really, at the end of the day, you know, she wanted to see those tears. And I think that we often think as men, like tears are a sign of weakness, but they're not, you know, and for our wife to know, like, she's not alone. She's grieving with us. And I think too, you know, we have these expectations too that maybe our priest will get it or people around us. And, you know, most priests have never lost a child. So I think we have to show mercy to them. But at the same time, you know, hopefully this book is like a resource that, you know, that someone would give to a priest to hand out to their parishioners or just even for him to understand, wow, like I didn't realize that, you know, I had a priest tell me it's time to move on. And this was after a couple months of our miscarriage. I'm like, I don't think I'll ever move on. And I think, and that's the beauty of, we had Dr. Sumter, I don't know if he's a doctor, he's a clinician, but he wrote a beautiful letter in the back of the book. And he just said, you know, grief isn't something to be fixed. And I think that really spoke to me because you're not going to fix it. And as men, we want to fix things. But if we can, you know, obviously heal and work through it, but you know, those memories of our children, whether they're in the womb that died or they're adult, they're always going to come back at certain points. And for us to be able to, you know, to handle and work through that grief in a way that leads us to God and not to despair and anger, I think that's one of the keys.
Yeah. As I read this, you quoted in your own story, you quoted different ways you paraphrase C.S. Lewis's A Grief Observed. Lewis talks about how it's not so much that he was afraid that he would stop believing in God. In fact, the greater danger was, oh, so this is what God is really like. Don't be deceived anymore. He puts you through this much pain. And he was afraid that his image of God the Father would become this. And I mean, in that pain of losing a child, I stand by this. I've been through quite a lot of pain in my own life, but I share this with my friends. Nothing compares to the pain of having lost our first two. You undergo a real trial of faith.
It is the greatest cross, hands down, losing the child. It's just something that really does, it puts you to the test, and it's, you know, it's one of the greatest trials that we can, and hopefully it is a trial that I believe that can make us into saints if we, you know, if we cooperate with God's grace.
Right. And just like you mentioned, handling this grief without the grace of God is an insurmountable task, because like you said, grief isn't something to be fixed, but it's a reality. It's something your soul goes through, the interiority of your being goes through it. And I remember those days, they were our first two, our first and second, we lost them, and we didn't have the comfort of a child to hold yet. And my bride and I leaned on each, and we had tried very hard to conceive as well. We had issues, as we've come to discover, a lot of couples have different issues conceiving. So when we finally did, we celebrated, and then we lost them. we just leaned on God and each other even more, because we knew that if we didn't, this was precisely the kind of thing that might break us.
It is, you know, there's a story in here with, you know, Joseph Pierce, the, you know, the great Catholic writer, and confided in me. He's like, you know, Patrick, I lost our second child, and it was from their daughter. They had a stillbirth 4 weeks before her due date. And so he puts his story in this book, and it's one of the most powerful ones. But he said at that moment, he felt as if he was being lifted up on the cross. And when he was holding his daughter, his stillbirth daughter, and he said, it was the first and only time in my life that I felt that I was actually crucified with Jesus. All the other times I felt that I was crucifying him, but at that moment I was with Jesus on the cross. And I really think that that's kind of an experience I felt that even though it was the darkest moment, it was also the moment where I felt like most closely conformed to Christ crucified.
You're listening to a conversation with Marcus Peter and Patrick O'Hearn, author of The Grief of Dads. We'll be back with more after this break.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Did you know my mom's gonna have a baby? We heard the heartbeat and my dad said this is gonna be someone very special.
Hello, my name is Marianne Koharski. I'm the director of Pro-Life Across America. We hope you'll consider supporting the work of Pro-Life Across America. Your gift will help offer life-saving alternatives to those in need. Visit our website at prolifeacrossamerica.org or like us on Facebook.
Pro-Life Across America.
Underwritten in part by the following nonprofit.
Are you paying high prices with a traditional health insurance company that pays for things that violate your conscience? There's an alternative available. Solidarity HealthShare is a community of faithful individuals and families that never share into immoral medical services, all while saving you money with prices starting as low as $85 per month for singles and $512 for families. Never fund another abortion with your healthcare dollars. Call 844-313-4999 to learn more.
When your children consider going to college, where are you going to find a place that will prepare them for the future and build on the foundation that you've laid? The answer? Ave Maria University. With an authentically Catholic curriculum, including 35 majors, AMU prepares students to take on the world.
My daughter told me she was published in a scientific journal as an undergrad. I'm so proud of her. The world needs Catholic physicists, and my daughter's going to be one of them.
Learn more at avemaria.edu. That's avemaria.edu.
Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
We make no bones here at EWTN and Ave Maria Radio that we are Catholic and that we are here to educate the Catholic faith. So we're very clear as to whom and what we represent. But you can't hide behind a title like the secular media do, claiming they're a news operation when it's nothing but propaganda for particular causes. It goes back to the pride of not admitting that maybe we need to look in the mirror and change some things. And I know from a personal perspective, I dug in my heels in terms of not wanting to leave the secular media. Oh no, I have a better plan. If you could just keep me here and let me make the big bucks and I'll still do my Christian thing here and there, we can be besties, God. It took me 3 years to finally say, I am yours, I was made for you, what do you want me to do?
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern. On EWTN Radio.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
St. Gregory of Nazianzus once said, "He who does acts of mercy should do so with cheerfulness. The grace of a good deed is doubled when it's done with promptness and speed." The best way most of us can learn this approach to Christian service is in our family lives. That's why prompt, generous, consistent, and cheerful attention to each other's needs is such an important part of the liturgy of domestic church life. Every day, ask each other this life-changing question. What's one small thing each of us can do to make each other's lives a little easier or more pleasant? Then, remember to do those things as a way of letting God's love shine out through you in your family. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
You're listening to the Ave Maria in the Afternoon, 2024 Year in Review. Welcome back. In this segment, we continue a conversation with Marcus and Patrick O'Hearn, author of The Grief of Dads, Support and Hope for Catholic Fathers Navigating Child Loss. Patrick had said something very profound in the last segment, that as he grieved the loss of his two children to miscarriage, he felt more conformed than ever to the suffering of Christ crucified. We'll continue that conversation with Marcus now.
We all cope with grief in different ways, and you even note in your chapter in the book that men cope with grief in different ways. And just very briefly, I know this sounds silly, but because my earliest experience of Jesus Christ came from my Assemblies of God background, my Pentecostal background, when all this happened, it happened during COVID for us, and so we were shut down, and we were just indoors, and I remember just going back to one of those early songs that I had learned. There were two songs. It was Casting Crowns, Praise You in the Storm, and While I'm Waiting. I forget who the author is of that song, the singer is of that song. And I remember singing those things just to get through each day until I was finally able to humanly function. But you also highlight how men cope with grief differently than women do. And that's something that's often taken for granted and not highlighted in society and in the church.
It is. You know, there's a beautiful line by Kelly Breaux, you know, and they're in charge of, they help write this book as well. They're in charge of Redbird Ministries, which is probably the only grief support that's in the United States for Catholic diocese. So Redbird, and Kelly said something so profound, and it took her to realize that men often retreat into the workshop like St. Joseph, while women ponder, you know, like Mary in their heart. And I think it's such a, you know, a beautiful illustration, which is so true. You know, we want to go and, you know, fix it or do these hobbies, while right. Women are, you know, these emotional. But some of the other common differences in the grief are that men generally grieve less intensely and less enduringly. We tend to cry less and talk less about the events, and we report, you know, less anxiety and depression immediately following the loss of the child. And we also, again, as we talked about earlier, men tend to feel more marginalized and less acknowledged about the loss. And so those are some of the few critical differences between the way men and women grieve.
Yeah. Right. And one of the things you highlight about that is because of this need and this innate drive to go and fix the thing. I remember doing that as well. I worked on my guitar. I took up a project and worked on my guitar just to take my mind off of it. So between work and that. But you also highlight how one of those things that can damage the marriage is the feeling that you could have prevented that great loss. And if you don't check that, if you don't acknowledge that and be very honest with yourself that you were powerless in the face of it, it could severely damage you and the relationship you have with your spouse.
Yeah, definitely. You know, regret is, you know, a big thing. Even in our miscarriages, we found out, you know, our house had toxic mold, the worst kind of toxic mold. So we discovered that after we got out of the house, but it made me realize, it's like, man, like, you know, what if I would have caught that leak earlier? Or, you know, just things that you wish, what if we would never have bought that house? I mean, there's just so many things that go through your mind. And then it's like, okay, Lord, like you allowed this to happen. And there's this element of surrender. And through all of these stories, you know, there's this element that I see in all these men, whether it's a miscarriage or even adult, but it just comes down to, like, just saying, Lord, you know, again, this element of surrender and trying to recall even the joyful times that you had, you know, if you were so blessed to even hold your child, just to hold on to those memories.
Right.
You know, going back to Saint Edith Stein, one of her good friends lost her husband, and Edith Stein was approaching her and just saw that joy from her. And that led Edith Stein to come into the Catholic faith because she saw how this woman had handled, you know, the death of her spouse. And I think the same way with us, you know, with our children, it's not, you know, obviously we're not going to be smiling the next day, but there comes this element where over time we realize that, you know, death does not have the final word.
Right. And you think about Kevin LeBlanc's chapter and Ryan's chapter on the loss of their children. That theme of having this hope in an afterlife, having this hope in an eternal beatific life in God, kept us going, that this hope of a baptism, the grace of a baptism of desire, despite the fact that for those of us who lost our children in the womb, they could not have received sacramental baptism, just this hope of the fact that God is our covenantal Father who loves us, and therefore we can hold out for that hope that if we enter into the beatific vision, we not only will experience reunification with those children, but that they are experiencing a kind of blessed afterlife. And that there's a kind of comfort there, there's a kind of consolation there, that it's uniquely Christian, that you don't find anywhere else.
It is, you know, I'm working on, I have this other book coming out in August with Sophia Press called Nursery of Heaven, and it focuses on, you know, it's for both men and women, infant loss, miscarriage and stillbirth, you know, just more those three areas. But one of the stories that I have in there, this lady, she saw her child, her miscarried baby, after Holy Communion, she received our Lord, and she saw her baby in heaven next to Mary, and that child had grown up. And again, there's a couple other stories in that book, too, with Mary appearing, holding the child. And so I really think, you know, in these times, it's like we have to believe that, like, Our Lady, you know, that she is, like, she wants our children, you know, she wants them to be with Jesus, and that, you know, that they're safe in her arms. And I think that gives us, again, that longing to be reunited with our children in heaven.
Right. And between that hope and longing of reunification and the hope of eternal happiness, there's also this wonderful reality that inasmuch as they were our biological children on this earth, they are infinitely more God's covenantal children. And He loves them and wants them infinitely in an infinitely elevated manner than you or I could possibly love them. And that's tough to comprehend when you're going through the grief of losing them.
It is, you know, and I think that's the reason why, you know, I mentioned in my story with, you know, Pope John Paul II, you know, he commissioned this theological commission, and Pope Benedict was at the head of it. And that came out in 2007, and he said, you know, Pope Benedict said, you know, there are theological and liturgical reasons to hope that infants who die without baptism may be saved and brought into eternal happiness. And I think, again, those are little things that we need in our, because, you know, obviously the devil wants to put lies in our head, like, you know, that this child was just, you know, a glump of tissue, wasn't
right.
But hey, God is like, no, I created this child, had meaning, it had life. And I think the testimony of that is, you just look at the post-traumatic stress. I mean, I went through it in some of the other authors, you know, especially after a miscarriage, you know, you wonder, that next child, is he going to make it? And you just, you know, Brian, the author, every ultrasound he would go to, it would cause him anxiety, just because, you know, his wife had three miscarriages. And so I think, again, just that, you know, we realize that, you know, this, you know, the way that you're suffering physically, it just shows you, like, in a sense, this grief, you know, it shows you how much you love that child. And so I think that those elements are definitely present, to speak to the sanctity of life when you realize, again, just the amount of grief you're going through.
Yeah. Yeah. The fear of it really doesn't go away. You pray and hope for a real safety and assurance of the life of the baby, the life of the mom, and you completely surrender to the providential love of the Father, admitting that half the time I really don't understand why certain things happen and why we never got to hold our first two, but we know that they are truly our children and God had a purpose and a plan for that.
Yeah, and that's why, you know, in the book too, it's, you know, it's important to name that child, you know, especially if it's a miscarriage, you know, it takes on life. And one thing that really struck me, you know, because I wrote about the different saints that went through child loss, and Saint Joseph, you know, I came across Venerable Maria of Agreda's writings, and she said that Saint Joseph nearly lost his life, you know, when Jesus was lost in the mm-hmm. temple. Like he couldn't eat, he couldn't sleep, and Mary basically was feeding him and saying, you know, stay alive. And I think that shows you, you know, sometimes we think, oh, the saints are so strong that they could handle anything, they can trust. But after I read that account of Saint Joseph, I realized, wow, like this guy, you know, he understood, you know, just, and he would have blamed himself, you know, had Jesus to hide, right? I mean, we wouldn't have, but just yeah. like, he felt like responsible. And I think, again, it just shows us that it's so important to grieve for our children and to not feel ashamed when we're, you know, when we're going through all these emotions, but to bring them to the Lord, you know, especially in the Eucharist, and say, Lord, you know, like, here, I'm suffering, I'm feeling anxious, I'm feeling, you know, I'm angry, and to help me. And I think, you know, the saints, Saint Joseph, and especially our Lord and our Lady, you know, they want to give us that trust and that peace.
Right. So, Patrick, we're down to just about a minute in the segment. And do you have an exhortation for families? Because undoubtedly, innumerable people listening in right now have undergone the loss and pain of having had children pass. Just a word of exhortation to find comfort in Christ and the Church.
I just want to say how much our Lord loves you, you know, loves you and your baby, and that you may not feel his presence, but he's holding you. He's drawing you to the cross, and at the same time Our Lady is, she waits with your son or daughter in heaven. And so I think that peace, just through Christ and Our Lady, just to have hope that you're not alone, you know, and that men like myself and you, Marcus, like, can we suffer with you as well?
You've been listening to a conversation with Marcus and Patrick O'Hearn, author of The Grief of Dads, Support and Hope for Catholic Fathers Navigating Child Loss, which is available in the online store at AveMariaRadio.net. Thanks for joining us on today's program. Have a blessed evening.